From GPB Radio, this is Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nigut. Today I'm going to talk to Lynn Rosetto Casper, the widely acclaimed and infectiously gregarious host of The Splendid Table, one of National Public Radio's most beloved programs. Casper's about to retire after hosting The Splendid Table for some 22 years. For all that time, at the heart of the show has been her love for food and cooking, subjects she discusses with such energy and excitement that listeners feel they're sitting at her kitchen table with a good friend. Yes, we'll talk about how she got her start, about her friendship with Julia Childs, and about food and spirits, too. But we have secrets to share, too. By choosing food over theater, the world was deprived of seeing the work of Claudia Randolph.
Oh, you've done your research,
Bill.
Who is
Claudia Randolph going to be? In 1992, our guest today, Lynn Rosetto Casper, published her first book. It was called The Splendid Table. It was Casper's deep exploration of the recipes and unique foods of Emilia-Romagna, a region of northern Italy that was almost unknown outside of the country. Food writers and book critics embraced it enthusiastically because, in addition to publishing some 200 recipes from Emilia-Romagna, Casper also wrote a scholarly but often romantic history of the region. She's been writing about food for magazines and newspapers for years, and she'd been teaching people how to cook for almost as long. But The Splendid Table elevated Casper to a new level of celebrity in the food community. The book won both the James Beard and the Julia Child Cookbook of the Year Award. One of the people who was captivated by the book was film and television producer Sally Swift. She soon partnered with Casper to create the program that took the name of Casper's much-lauded first book, The Splendid Table. The show started as a weekly call-in program on Minnesota Public Radio. 22 years later, it's heard on more than 400 stations in the United States and beyond, and Casper and Sally Swift are still working on the show together.
This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rosetto Casper.
But that run is coming to an end as Casper prepares to retire at the end of the year. So now let me get personal for a minute. My wife and I are huge fans of Casper and her show, and there was no way I was going to miss the chance to look back on her life and career before Casper moves on. So we arranged a conversation, Casper in her studio in Minneapolis and me here in the Two-Way Street studio in Atlanta. Since we couldn't see each other, and since Casper really didn't know me from Adam, we began just making sure we were connected.
Is that Bill?
Yeah. Hi, Lynn. My name, I'm Bill Nigut.
Nigut. Nigut. All right. I'm infamous, really, in my own life for two things.
Yes.
A, not remembering people's names, even though I can remember many things about them. And B, I mispronounce anything that I can.
Lynn, welcome to Two-Way Street. It's a real pleasure to have you here. What's for lunch?
I'm going home to make lunch.
All right, what are you going to make?
Well, you see, you don't really want to hear this, do you?
Yeah, I do, of course. Are you kidding? What is Lynn Rosetto Casper having for lunch? Of course I want to hear that.
Well, first of all, I'm a quinoa nut. And now, this is a confession, but I've done this for years. My local co-op does a dynamite quinoa tabbouleh. And so that's waiting in the fridge. But what I'm going to do with that is a big salad. And the salad, I have some nice Parmigiano was hanging around. Mm. And, you know, since it's rather expensive, I use it in small nuggets. And the last of the basil leaves from my basil plant, which is looking like it's, you know, ready to say we're over.
Yeah.
And so I mix that all up with a lemon and garlic and a bit of parsley. And it's like a pesto. And it's like going to be a dressing on my salad. So that's my lunch.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you for sharing that.
You are more than welcome.
You know, quinoa is an example to me of a food that suddenly bursts on the scene and everyone is talking about it, eating it. I remember many years ago when Asiago cheese, everybody started talking about Asiago cheese in bagels. And I always wondered, is there like an Asiago cheese association that starts marketing? Where did quinoa suddenly come on the scene?
I remember we lived in Colorado for about 5 years, from 76 to 81. And right after that, we moved to Europe. But one of my buddies there, who was involved in the local food scene up to his ears, sent me something. And he said, there are some people on the Western Slope who are growing this grain. It's from Peru. It is supposedly, extremely healthy. But what I love about it is it tastes good and has this crackle. But you have to treat it a bit. And there were those little seeds. And what you had to do at that time, because there's a coating on quinoa, when we buy it now, it's gone. But at that time, what you had to do is you soaked it and then you kind of toasted it. And it was delicious. Now, this is in 1982. And it wasn't easy to get, but he would send me care packages. And then it started to explode on the scene. And I think one of the reasons this has happened is because of climate change. Because here you have a grain that can grow in really bad conditions. This does not need fertilizer. It can be beaten. You know, it needs lousy soil, et cetera. And it grows in Peru, and it grows, you know, at altitudes, at fairly high up, and it grows on crummy land. And I think when people began realizing we needed plant sources for proteins, it has more protein than a lot of other plants do, and something that tastes good, and it cooks in 15 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not like other greens where you need a much more time. So you have that factor there, and then you have one other factor. Everybody wanted to get their hands on quinoa seeds. You know, it was going to be a huge money crop, and it is. I am not up to date on this situation, but we did an interview about 2 years ago because the area that this comes from is a very poor area. And this crop is one of the main supporters of this very large area. Let's call it this community. And the interesting thing is that what they were trying to do was the kind of thing large corporations have done. But this was to protect their culture and, you know, the lives of their people, which was more or less trademark it, protect it, not allow the seed to go away. And this became, of course, a great area of conflict, because on one hand, you want to see the world being able to eat, you know, from plants as opposed to animals, and you want to be able to have it be affordable, and my gosh, how convenient can it get? And on the other hand, you're looking at an entire culture, and the government was behind this of that country. That was the other thing, because they saw the destruction. It's very interesting what happens as your world situation changes, how other things shift, all these kinds of things. You know, it's that business that you drop the pebble in the pond and all of those rings go out.
Yeah.
And what do those rings do? And this is just one small example of, you know, it looked like it was going to be a lifesaver, and it could be. But what does it do? Let me put it this way. You buy local, and that's really important.
Yeah.
But what happens to the fruit picker in Mexico or in Chile when, you know, there's not enough of a market for those people to be growing?
Yeah, you make the point that it is much more complicated. If we want to be good world citizens, if we want to support agriculture in our own areas, we also have to be thinking about what's happening in other parts of the world. Here's what I love about what just happened as we really begin our conversation. You just demonstrated why your program has been such a remarkable success for more than two decades. We talked very quickly. I asked you about quinoa, and you were able to talk about it in such engaging terms with so much knowledge. And this is what people have loved about you for two decades. And I think it's one of the reasons, well, it's true, but I think it's one of the reasons that in some ways this is a sad conversation, because we're talking to you as you're beginning to wind down more than two decades of the Splendid Table. But thank you for demonstrating why your show has been such an enormous success for all those years. You know everything, Lynn.
No, I don't. No, and, you know, as I said about the Peru situation, I'm way behind on that. You know, but you know, the other thing is, I think you see this in the media a lot, and I think it's a great idea. Okay, guys, now go out and catch up, learn more, that kind of thing. Because this gets not only interesting, but it becomes something that gets a bit on the vital side, shall we say? But thank you. I'm blushing, and I'm going to get teary, and I refuse to do that. Not on air, anyway.
Well, we're going to talk about what's next for you. But I want to, let's talk about your career for a few minutes, if we can, okay?
Sure.
I was looking for a quote, looking for something that I thought was a good starting point for the conversation, and I found this. You at one point said, when I cook, it's when all the senses are engaged. And whatever is going on in life, it all falls away. Right now, it's you and that onion. Right now, you're boiling the pasta if you're making something. Your hands, your sense of smell, your sense of taste, and even your sense of humor. And you go on to say that if it doesn't work, big deal. One dish in your life is not, that's not perfect. It's just the engagement, and you deserve that. That's really an entire philosophy about cooking in that paragraph.
Well, I guess it is. Yeah, and I'm. By the way, don't misunderstand. That doesn't mean that, you know, when things are crashing down or just when I've had a rotten day, I bound into the kitchen and it all goes away and suddenly I'm singing, you know, with joy. But there is something to be said for a mindful approach to it, which is, I just did this yesterday. You know, I've got all these, it's like all of us, you know, I have to get that done. And oh my God, I completely forgot about this. And make a list, Casper. Yes, you did, dear. And now you can't find the list. That kind of thing's going on in your mind. And I decided I really wanted to make myself a nice supper. And I started working, and it was peeling an onion. And I said, you're not enjoying this. You're thinking of 10 things. So I stopped and I took a slow 5 deep breaths. And I thought to myself, this onion and I are not going to meet quite this way again, ever. You know, I mean, it's just this little moment between the onion and I. And a lot of it did fall away. Because the nature of eating and the nature of especially of cooking and then eating, it does involve all our senses. And when you involve your senses, it's a different kind. I think the chemistry changes in our systems. And especially if things, you know, they smell good or you just start to feel good. You know, the last of the tomatoes, and they're so gorgeous. Okay. Well, you bring them into your life. You eat them as you're making the dish. I don't want to belabor it, but yeah, it's gotten me through a lot. And for me, it's food. For other people, it might be something. It might be music. It might be science. There's these doorways that we all have. I have had this theory for a long time. I'm very visual in my head. And my theory is that everything that connects us to the universe, to each other, you know, to the earth, whatever, is all in one room. And it's also all the knowledge. And that basically we humans are kind of curious. We're a little scared about things or whatever. We're basically curious. We have to keep moving forward. It's just the way we are. And this room can be entered through any number of doorways, but that's kind of where we all want to get to. And we want to get to connect with each other, too. And so my doorway has been food. It's also been art. Mm-hmm. And it's been, you know, senses. But as I said, everyone has a different doorway. Everyone has something or more than one thing that lights up inside. For me, I know I'm really, really engaged. I feel like there's a thumping, a humming way down, I guess you could say, in my gut. And when the writing is going well, that happens. And when you have those moments with people where you realize you're not thinking about what you're going to be saying next, you're listening. You know, you're just totally open. You're like this big, open flower. And, you know, come on, you know, I want to hear it all. And it's not I anymore. Those moments come about for a lot of reasons. And the engagement of all your senses helps a lot.
You grew up in an Italian household in Paramus, New Jersey? Is that where you were?
Paramus, New Jersey, yes. Pronounced, by the way, through the nose, and I hope nobody there is offended. But a Joyzy, well, that's really not a Joyzy accent. But anyway, it's sort of Paramus sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's how I said it for years.
When did you actually start cooking? How old were you when you started working in the kitchen with your, I assume, mother?
Well, I was with my mother. I was busy hanging from trees and riding horses that I found in fields, which get you into a heck of a lot of trouble, and all that kind of stuff. And I always walked around with a sketch pad, or most of the time. But I really was interested in what was going on. And my father passed away when I was 15. My grandmother was with us. She was a semi-invalid. And my mother worked very long hours. She often worked nights. And so I did cook. And what I made is an embarrassment to anyone who is serious about food. But you have to remember, I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorite things was that I wasn't allowed to eat white bread, only whole wheat bread. I would take a piece of whole wheat bread and I would toast it. And then I would take a can of beans, you know, like Campbell's beans, and I would mix them with mustard and sweet relish, if I remember, and maybe a little chopped onion. But I think that happened when I was much more mature. And I would pile that on the toast, and I would put a piece of a, thank God forbid, American cheese on it, and I would put it in the oven. And that, and I had never heard about baked beans on toast at that point, you know, from England. And that was something I was terribly, terribly proud of. And but later on, as years passed, I guess probably about one or two, I learned to make the family pasta sauce. And that took a lot of time, and that was my pride and joy. But when my mother liked it, I was just over the moon about it.
Well, was that a basic, and when I say basic, I don't mean to insult it, but was that a tomato sauce? Did it also have sausage accompanying it? How did you make that sauce?
Oh, God, this sauce was numbered in half. First of all, you chopped celery, carrot, and onion. And then you slowly browned that in olive oil, very slowly, and you added garlic. And then you added about half a can of tomato paste. And you cooked that down, and then you added about a cup of wine. I just remembered watching my mother pour from the wine bottle, so I figured it out. And I did remember she showed me how to boil it down, which I think back now, that was probably a saving grace. Otherwise, cooking just in wine, you know, can really get bad. And then what went into it was, I think, ground meat. Probably ground beef and a bit of pork, and chopped chicken innards, you know, the liver, the gizzard, the heart, minced up. And that went in, and then what you did was you added the tomatoes, not a huge amount of tomatoes. My mother's family was from Tuscany, and my father's family was from Venice. And very different styles of cooking into those areas. But this was much more of a sauce of that era or that period. Anyway, that's how I made it. And I had to cook for a long time. And so that was my big production number. And then, well, not too long after that, I think I got the cooking bug even off earlier than when my father passed away. My father and mother had started building a garage before he passed on. And it was a big, elaborate thing, you know, and one of the things was that it was going to have shake shingles, you know, those split shingles that were very expensive. They were real wood. And I had been reading about all kinds of methods that the Indians and other peoples had built fires to cook food. So while everybody was working away, the family would come up on weekends and they would be on ladders and they'd be up, you know, on this roof. And there were these big piles, you know, wrapped up of the shingles, which was cedar. And cedar is a wonderful wood to cook over.
You know, it's funny that you would have recognized that so many years ago, because now, of course, people love to buy cedar chips to flavor food when they're, grilling.
Oh, yeah. I just knew it was really smelly and nice. And also, it wasn't a log. And you know, I mean, we had a side yard, and I had dug a hole, and I had lined it with flat stones. And and nobody was paying any attention to the kid, you know, because they were all working, and they had cement mixer going and all of this. And I had lined it up, and I had put the cedar shingles in there, and I had lit them and burn them down and then burn down more and burn down more until I got a whole pile of coals and the stones were hot. And I think I jury-rigged a grill, and we had lamb chops.
Wow.
And I grilled the lamb chops, probably too hot. And they were probably like, you know, eating rubber. And then the moment came, late in the day, maybe the early evening when everyone was sitting around, you know, plates on their laps. And I don't remember, there were other things, of course, to eat. And my uncle was asking me, how did you do this? And I said, well, you know, there was this wood and it was already chopped. And the horror on everyone's faces, I had gone through, I don't know how many dollars worth of cedar shingles. And we were not rich. So, you know, I did the same thing when I first was with my husband. And he showed me that in the bottom of a closet was his little wine rack. And he said, now, when you're cooking, you use anything you want. I didn't know a lot about wine then. And I would do these wonderful sauces, you know, where you'd like those are the days we ate meat.
Yeah.
And you'd have a steak, but I would get bones and I would brown the bones with the celery and the carrot and the onion, you know, the Holy Trinity. And then I would get these beautiful red wines and I'd pour a little over and boil it down and pour a little over and boil it down. It's a great technique to build dimension, right? And then the moment would come when I'd serve dinner and he would go to get his bottle of the Bordeaux we paid by those day, you know, in those days, a fortune for, and it was gone. And I had gone through, and by the time we reached these moments, a serious amount of that wine.
Oh.
And yeah, and he was, you know, this was one of the tests of a relationship. And I felt terrible, but I said, you'd sit to use anything I want. And, I mean, I think he raised his eyes to heaven and figured, I guess I'm going to have to deal with this for a while.
So. Yeah. You know, I was thinking, as you said that, when I make a turkey chili that my family likes, I love to add a little bit of whiskey to it. And I tend to use the cheapest, decent whiskey I can find instead of going into the liquor cabinet and finding that $90 bottle of bourbon to...
which would probably be wasted in a chili because, you know, the $90 bottle of bourbon, which I would tell you to put a padlock on.
Yeah.
By the way, that wouldn't be a Pappy Van Winkle, would it?
No. Oh, my gosh, no. Have you ever had Pappy Van Winkle?
I have to tell you, for folks, if you haven't heard of Pappy Van Winkle, it's probably the best thing for your bank account.
Yeah.
It's a glorious, glorious bourbon, extraordinarily expensive, right, Bill?
Yeah, I mean, I think, in fact, you can't even buy. They produce it in very small quantities now, and you have to enter a lottery to be able to pay like $900 to $1,000 to have the right to buy a bottle of Pappy Van Winkle. I've seen it served in bourbon bars in Kentucky where they'll give you about two shots for somewhere around $160.
I've seen it on menus at about that price.
Yeah.
I have one friend who is extraordinarily generous, and as he said to me, he asked me for the first time we met, are you by any chance into brown spirits? And I had to stop and think for a minute because, oh, wait a minute, of course, scotch and bourbon and whiskey. And it went on, you know, and I said, well, not really, but I have enjoyed, you know, that occasional single malt and I really love bourbon. And he served me Pappy Van Winkle.
Wow.
And I don't claim any immense expertise in bourbon. But in this business, as Paula Wolfert, the wonderful food writer, once said, we tend to eat and drink far above our means, either thanks to others or us making foolish purchases with the rent money. And it was really, it's like drinking silk. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
But, you know, but anyway, no, I was just wondering. But something like that would be lost in something that has a lot of flavoring. But a good tasting and expensive. Normally, I use wines that are very inexpensive, and they're really good.
Sure.
And I serve them.
Sure.
Because they're really good. But my Bordeaux experience was a revelation.
We're going to take a break right now. When we come back, more with Lynn Rossetto Casper, the acclaimed host of NPR's The Splendid Table. Casper's getting set to retire at the end of the year after 22 years as the original and only host for all that time. If you're just joining us, my guest on Two Way Street today is the longtime host of NPR's The Splendid Table, Lynn Rossetto Casper.
Casper's retiring from the show at the end of this year after serving as host for its entire 22 years on the air. Casper grew up in an Italian family in New Jersey and began cooking at a very early age. She went on to become a cooking instructor, an award-winning author of books on food and cooking, and the guiding light behind The Splendid Table, which she calls the show for people who love to eat. When did you decide, after your lamb chops cooked on wood, on cedar, after your tomato sauce, your mother's recipe, when did you decide that food was going to be your professional life?
Well, you know, it was a process of elimination, and it was a process of being slap dab in the front row of the so-called food revolution, which began in the late 60s in New York and really launched in the 70s. I was at a point where I had been working, and I'd been working at a job I really didn't like, and I didn't know what I wanted to do when I grew up, because the things I had loved when I was in school was theater and art. And, you know, those aren't things you decide to go out and make a living at. I had done a lot of tryouts and that kind of thing. And, you know, you're just not going to pay the bills as an actress. And I loved the idea of set and costume design, but I wasn't trained for that. So at any rate, I met my husband. And to be quite honest, we ended up living together in the days when people still occasionally raised eyebrows. And he said to me, look, you're doing a job you hate just to pay the rent. And yes, I know you want to contribute and whatever, but why don't you use this time to really explore what you want to do? So I got a part-time job, and the rest of the time I tried things. And I had always cooked at that point. I loved to cook at that point. And I was started learning Chinese cooking at that point. And I suddenly realized I tried this and I tried that and I liked it, but it wasn't something that rang inside of my gut. Something that was something that made me so curious, I knew I was never going to wear it out. And it dawned on me that what I was doing almost every night and what I was reading about in bed was probably something I could do, because at that time people had begun teaching cooking.
Mm-hmm.
There was a restaurant school. We were living in New York City and then in Brooklyn. And in Brooklyn there was a community college. There at that time in France there was an award. It was given, I think, either worldwide or France and America for the finest professional, you know, cooking schools for the trade. And this one had won a silver medal. But the thing was, I started taking courses. And then what I started to do, I had really had gotten serious about Chinese cooking, which is a long story. But anyway, I had a wonderful mentor, and it was at the time when some really fine books on the subject, written by people from the culture, were coming out. And between the books and this person I was working with, and I lived, you know, 15 minutes from Chinatown, I started doing serious Chinese cooking. We started doing feasts, which is a whole other sort of cooking. You know, it's celebration food. And every month we would do a feast for 10 people from a different part of China. And finally someone said, would you teach us? And I said, well, you know, this is the teacher reading the book the night before the class. And someone said, you know the book to read. And that's how it began. And I ended up going from there. I was as happy as I could be, absolutely be. And I ended up, there was a local department store in Brooklyn where we lived that was like a family institution. It had been there for generations. And they had a position called a gourmet consultant. This was the first department store that had a supposed expert cooking every day and teaching who was in the housewares department but wasn't selling anything. And picked what they wanted to use or not and had free hand in telling the buyers what they really should be buying or what really worked and they need more of. And that was me. I was the second person to take on that job. And I just loved it. And from there, I began teaching professionally, and it went on from there. But it was this gradual realization that what made me happiest was all these aspects of food. And the most profound thing someone said to me at that time, I had to decide between this job and a job. I had a theater group, a street theater group. We did improv. You know, we'd block off a street in New York City or in Brooklyn, and we'd do children's theaters, children's improv. And the Brooklyn Academy of Music were looking at us as their resident children's theater. And I had started the group with a friend. And there was this job offer, and a friend of mine, I didn't know which one to do. And it wasn't a sure thing with the Academy, obviously. But anyway, a friend said, you know, if that succeeds, there's 20 of you. But this is you alone. And if you succeed, well, you did it yourself. And if you fall flat on your face, you did it yourself and you know where you have to learn. She said, you know, I don't know anything about food, but I kind of think it's like the fingers of your hand. You know, your palm is the food, but it can kind of take you in all these directions. Now, can you imagine anything that was more profound in terms of what's happening in food today than that?
By choosing food over theater, I do want to point out that the world was deprived of seeing the work of Claudia Randolph.
Oh, you've done your research, Bill.
Who is Claudia Randolph going to be, Lynn?
Well, Claudia Randolph. Now, you have to remember, I was raised as Lynn Rossetto, Italian on both sides, and a name that everybody used, pronounced incorrectly, Rossetto. And I was raised in the suburbs of New York, and I was one of those kids. I was told from age 5, now I think that's an exaggeration, who couldn't wait to move into the city and take on the world. And when theater came along, I mean, come on. You're going to put Lynn Rossetto, and my family, I apologize. I'm not saying I was ashamed of the name, but I couldn't see it on a marquee. It just didn't fly. And what do you want to be when you come from Southern Europe and you're Italian and whatever? Well, you want to be an Anglo-Saxon white Protestant. You want to have long blonde hair. You wear a headband. But my vision was Claudia Randolph. Claudia was one of my many middle names. I came by it rightly. Claudia Randolph wore beautifully tailored tweeds and a magnificent cape and wonderful soft leather boots. And she tramped across the moors in the fall as the wind was blowing in her hair. And she could do grand things on stage. Now, you have to remember, she was 18 years old, maybe 20. But that was what I used as my stage name.
Is there a chance that you could, in your retirement from Splendid Table, look to get involved in theater? Go back to that passion?
I'm thinking about it. The thing is, to make this short, what I'm doing now and what I've come to realize is it really, forging a new life is forging. And I find that I thought I was going to leap into things, and I did to a certain point. I also lost my husband in the midst of all of this 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's another huge change in retirement, and we moved. But I'm feeling my way, and I find that things I couldn't think of a year ago that, oh, God, I know, I just can't do that. And now it's, oh, I can't, I think I'll try that. You know, it's that alive piece in you that says, you know, that's really intriguing. I wonder what'll happen. Or, boy, I'd love to help someone with that. So it's, you know, it's like the petals of a flower. We keep opening up and opening up and opening up. I think it's possible. I think I would love to try it. I would love to try it privately.
you ended up in Minneapolis, and of course there's a wonderful theater community in Minneapolis.
The Guthrie
Theater would probably love to have you.
Well, there's also so many other theaters
here
too.
Sure, of course.
Not to knock the Guthrie, but my Lord, we're crawling with good theater.
Yeah.
So I am thinking of taking some improv classes because I studied improv a long time ago.
Let's take another break. My guest today is Lynn Rossetto Casper, the host of NPR's The Splendid Table. You're listening to Two Way Street. Get back to my conversation with Lynn Rossetto Casper, the longtime host of NPR's The Splendid Table. She'll retire from the show at the end of this year after serving as host for its entire 22 years on the air. How did you get to know Julia Childs?
Oh, boy. Okay. How did I get to know Julia Child? Okay. I think the first time was Julia. Oh, boy. This is hard. I know what it was. Yes. Okay. Let's go back to that department store in Brooklyn. Okay. And this is the very beginning of my seriously working in food. Julia had come out. She had been on air. She was a goddess. She had never appeared in public, never had cooked in public. And she was coming out with volume two of Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And because we had the only food program in the United States in a large area that had a publicity department, et cetera, they chose us for her to do her first public demo. And we received schematics for building a kitchen. And, you know, in a large department store, you have a lot of space that is used for special events. We had the advertising wherewithal. We were required to have, it had to be free. Free seating for 250 people. And I mean, the schematics for the kitchen where the plug had to be here, the counter had to be there. And she was my goddess. And she arrived with her publisher, Alfred Knopf, his wife, who was a famous, famous hostess and one of the great women of New York, Mildred Knopf, her producer, Ruth, whose last name just dropped out of my head, and Paul. And
her husband.
And Paul was in charge of making sure all the mechanics were going to work. And he came up and he looked at everything and he said, "You've got to move this plug here. This isn't right here. And I was terrified. And Julia took one look at me, and I think she saw a woman who was looking at the, you know, the deer in the headlights. And she put her arm around me. Now, I was much taller then. And here was a woman who was significantly taller than I was. And she put her arms around my shoulder, and she said, "Dearie, show me the kitchen where you usually work," which was one of the most endearing. She got me out of there. And she was magnificent. She was playful and she was wonderful. But Bill, here was the very best part. We only had room for 250, right? And we figured that'll be fine. We'll talk about miscalculating. People camped out. Now, it was summer, but people camped out outside. And it was a party. There were little tents pitched on the sidewalk. This is the middle of Brooklyn, for God's sake. Overnight, there people had brought food and wine and, you know, sharing. It was amazing. So they had to open up a whole other area and they put in, you know, quickly put in monitors and cameras so at least people could see what was going on. And that was good enough. But then as we opened the doors for the 250 seating, in the back of the room, a huge banner went up in red, white, and blue across the whole back of the room saying, "Viva Julia." And the head of the PR department turned to me and she said, "That was a really good plan." I had nothing to do with it. It was totally spontaneous. So I spent more time talking to Paul that day than I spent talking to Julia. But she wrote me the loveliest note thanking me. And then she came to Denver. This was several years later. We had moved to Denver and I had opened a school. And I had I arranged this so we would supply all the equipment for the kitchen from the shop that was connected with the school. And I ended up on stage prepping with her for 2 days. And we would stop and have lunch, wine, you know, omelets cooked, etc. And she was wonderful. And she wrote me this lovely note. And my husband was so proud. He collected old cars. And he was Julia and Paul's chauffeur for the entire time.
Oh, and you two became good friends.
Well, if not close friends because of me. She wrote me a note at that point. I was so touched. She said, "I hope we become very good friends." I was always a little too much in awe of her. You know, for all you accomplish, there's always someone you just think is so glorious and you get nervous. But what she did when Splendid Table, and we worked together on and off during that time, and we had some very good times together. But the loveliest thing she did was when Splendid Table came out and I was on a book tour. And in those days, book tours were studies in how to kill an author. You know, if you came back refreshed and rested, you'd failed. And I was going to be in Boston for an entire week. And I got a call from the PR person about 2 weeks ahead saying, "Lynn, there's this woman in Boston who would like you to stay with her while you're here." And I had explained, as most authors do, please don't put me with people, because when you when you're done for the day, all you want to do is stare at the wall and suck your thumb and sleep. And you don't want to be social and you don't want to be rude. And she said, well, you know, Lynn, she really loves the book. In fact, she's going to give it to her family for Christmas. And she does this with one cookbook every year. And I said, you know, tell her I'll take her to lunch. And finally, she was dealing obviously with someone who was very dense. And she said, Lynn, it's Julia Child. Well, I stayed with Julia and she had her nephew there who was working on a book. And she knew exactly what I was dealing with. She was out more than I was. But we had this dinner together. She picked one event to come to, which I didn't expect at all. She picked the event with the most press and the most local food people, which was so touching. Now, maybe it was just that it fitted into her schedule, but she was too savvy for that. I was so touched. And then she took me out to dinner. And, you know, it's very hard. I don't know if you found this when you're performing or when you accomplish something, you know, that's public, that it's very hard to make friends with it at times.
Yeah.
And I kept looking at that book that I worked on for, you know, I took 10 years of research. And it wasn't mine. You know, it's very strange. It wasn't mine. I didn't do that. And she said to me over dinner, she said, Lynn, you know, you've written a seminal work. And I this is what was going on my and she looked at me, you know, kind of frowning. She said, Lynn, do you know what the word seminal means? And, you know, I was tongue-tied, but we would meet every night around midnight for what we would call a libation. And we'd drink a little bit of gin together. I like it with lime. And we'd talk. And that was the most relaxed.
Well, and which book was that one? Because obviously
that was the very first one. Okay. That was The Splendid Table, and that was about 500 years of cooking in a single Italian region.
And what do you believe Julia Child meant when she said it was a seminal work? What do you think you accomplished with that book that would lead her to say that?
I think it's not unique, but I think that was the book that originally I thought publishers were going to look at and say this is a scholarly book or a book that includes a lot of history and storytelling and nobody's going to read it. It's about a place nobody's ever heard of. And Emilia Romagna. I mean, how many people have heard it? They hear it, Tuscany and whatever. But anyway, and I worked with a brilliant editor, Maria Guarnaschelli, and I knew I had stories to tell. And I knew this is where I think also the theater comes in. The first thing you have to do when you want to communicate with people is get their attention. Do something in a way that you're not starting up there because you've spent all these years learning and fascination with the subject. Start where you started, you know, where this is really an interesting place. This is why it's interesting. And that was the approach I used. And it went through, I don't know how many drafts. It was a hard job to write. But it changed my life. It was, I think, one of the first books of its kind that really sold, that got a lot of recognition. And I guess because of the show, it's still on bookshelves. Because it was telling stories, and it was time travel.
Yes.
And it was, you know, the time travel was often about one of the most romantic and exciting periods, and also complicated ones, in Italian history, the Renaissance. And the Renaissance played out at the tables of the nobility of Italy, and especially this region, so magnificently and with so much intrigue. And, you know, this was the era of the Borgias, where a pope with three children or two children was a pope. and Lucretia Borgia, you know, marrying her usually meant you had an early demise. I think it just caught the imagination.
Yeah.
And then a lot of things started to happen. And I think, and I say this in all modesty because God knows other people have been writing about things like this for a long time and had done a brilliant job. But I think because of it winning awards and stuff like that, it really opened the door for a lot more of this.
And it was the beginning of why you ended up eventually with The Splendid Table on public radio. Obviously.
That's right.
Okay, so let's go to Splendid Table. It does strike me that your love of theater, your training as an actor has certainly played a role in the success of your show. And by that I mean you know how to tell a story. You know how to engage us. You're a really strong communicator. And I wonder if sometimes you think that is the actress in you understanding how to reach people on the subject of food.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I don't think training like that goes away. And I'm by nature a tad operatic and a little, shall we say, dramatic. And I do tend at times to embroider things because I often see experiences as being terribly exciting that other people look at and say, who cares? But yes, of course, I think so. And you know, one of the things I remember, there's two things that I think you don't have to have theater experience to know, but having the theater experience helps a bit, is first of all, when life is really not very kind, nobody listens in to hear your tears. I mean, you know, not the actual tears, but the sadness. Unless that's what you're going to talk about and be extremely personal. And the other thing is that, you know, our lives can be chaotic. But one of the great things, and this applies to the whole crew, we have an incredible crew. Sally Swift, our managing producer, was my partner in crime. We created the show together. Mm-hmm. And then we have our tech director, Jenny Lubke, who will spend 10 minutes working on one breath to edit. And then we have Jennifer Russell, who is our other producer. And Jennifer is the person who finds a lot of the people. You know, we'll say we need someone at X, but Jen is out there all the time. So anyway, the point is that with all of us, it works the same way. When the door closes on the studio and the control room, all the stuff from our lives is on the outside. And you're totally focused, or you try to be, on the engagement of talking to one person. And by gum, after a while, the stuff that's outside disappears for a while. It's great. It's like being on vacation.
Yeah.
And especially, you know, people are, I love the call-ins. You can play. You know, we all love the idea that we can laugh or we can communicate in many different ways. And it's a privilege to do that. So, yeah, I think, of course, it all adds up and it helps.
It does seem to me that we are living through a period of the chef as a true celebrity. Now, I mean, you can go back to the New York days and say there were people who were emerging back then. But it does seem to me that chefs today are living in a world of celebrity unlike what they have in the past. In many major cities, we have them here in Atlanta. We have celebrated chefs who people follow from one restaurant to the next in mm-hmm. ways that never happened before. Has that been a good thing for the food business?
I think it's been a great thing for the food business. I mean, the chef was the blue-collar worker. A chef, you know, and the poor, I mean, this was a way that, my God, your knees went, your feet went, you never made enough money, you worked 12 hours a day sweating. There were great chefs. There have been great chefs since day one. There was probably a great chef when people were, you know, living in caves. But I think it's wonderful that the chef is getting recognition. But, you know, everything in life has a flip side. And the flip side is there's a lot of recognition for people who have no idea what they're doing.
Hmm.
And that said, there's so much talent out there. And I think it's great that so many people, I mean, now you look at people who are quitting, you know, well, good paying jobs to essentially do something that takes a long time to get recognition.
Yeah.
And a lot of people think they're going to go to restaurant school and then they're going to have their own show. And if they're very compelling as people on air, they just might. But it is interesting to me because all this is saying that this interest in food and this exploration is growing and growing and growing. And the other thing, look at the awareness of agriculture and food, of where our food comes from. Can you imagine anybody opening a restaurant and not saying it's farm to table?
One of the reasons we are living in a time when people are more aware of chefs and the art of cooking, the joy of cooking, it strikes me, is because of the extraordinary work you've done on Splendid Table for so long now. And we're all going to miss you very, very much, Lynn. I know Frances Lamb will come in and do a fine job, probably a wonderful job. But you are going to be sorely missed. And I only hope that I'll get a chance to come see you in a great play somewhere in the United States in your next career.
Bill, thank you. And Frances is doing a wonderful job. But thank you very much. I'm going to miss it a lot.
I enjoyed having the conversation. Lynn Rosetto Casper, thanks again for being on Two Way Street.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Bill.
Bye. When Lynn Rosetto Casper steps down from The Splendid Table, she'll leave the show in the hands of Francis Lamb. He's been a frequent guest and contributor to the show. Lamb has been a judge on Top Chef Masters, wrote a food column for the New York Times Magazine, and has written for a number of other national magazines. Meanwhile, I hope Casper finds a great improv class so she can hone her acting chops. And who knows, maybe sometime down the road we'll see the stage debut of Claudia Randolph, a.k.a. Lynn Rosetto Casper. That's all the time we have for this week's show. Our senior producer is Jenny Ament. Jenny edited today's show. Olivia Rheingold is our associate producer, and Tyler Morris is our engineer. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. See you back again next week for another Two-Way Street.